Hello, welcome to Mod Midwives, a Metro Midwifery podcast. I'm Gina Gerbach.
And I'm Nedra Hale, and we are home birth midwives serving the Denver metro area.
Well, here we are. It's podcast time again. It really seems to sneak up on us, even though we've cut it in half. We've cut the podcast in half, and it still seems like it comes up just as frequently. So I got into a little funny argument this weekend. I don't frequent mom boards or groups or things like that very often, but once in a while I just do, and I just can't help myself, and I make a comment and it comes off, you know, maybe not as compassionate as it should. And I got myself into a little comment war on a TikTok video this weekend. Well, it really had nothing to do with breastfeeding, which is what we're going to talk about today, breastfeeding and chest feeding rates in the United States. But it did have to do with mom shaming and mommy wars and how we're all in this together and we just need to support each other. And it just got me thinking. The comment was about this person, this very sweet young mom, her personal favorite and least favorite products. And she made a number of recommendations, 80% of which I totally disagreed with. and partly because we've talked about this before, I'm just kind of a minimalist. I just don't think you need a bunch of stuff for your babies.
Same.
So there's just all these ideas that you need all these really expensive things. And I just think it's dumb. But besides that, the products she was promoting were very, I don't know. I don't want to say separation oriented, but they weren't attachment promoting. How about that? The product she was the products she liked were things that could interfere with a parent's attachment to their baby. And as we've talked about, and you can go back on the podcast if people want to go back and read or listen to previous podcasts, we've talked about how much we support the attachment parenting style of parenting. And because, I mean, that's what, not only is that what we did, but because we know that it really works, particularly when it comes to supporting and promoting breastfeeding and chest feeding. So that's kind of the bottom line, is that this sort of connected style of parenting facilitates breastfeeding. And that's, you know, one of the ways that you can make a way that you can meet your breastfeeding goals is to sort of have a more attached style of parenting. And so it's no surprise that this was not a breastfeeding parent, and breastfeeding didn't even really come up in the conversation of her video, but or the comments on the video. But anyway, I got myself in a little bit of an argumentative situation because, and by the way, I've been doing this since the late 90s. I've been in the middle of all kinds of, you know, internet debates and arguments. And I just almost never have the capacity for it now, but for whatever reason, I got myself into it again this weekend, and it made me realize there's just a shortage of context. There's a lack of context. And so people are making these statements about, oh, well, you do you, I'll do me. This is my favorite thing. This can be your favorite thing. But really, there's kind of a deeper level of misunderstanding about how these choices are negatively impacting breastfeeding and chest feeding rates in the United States. So, and I did not even talk about that on the video or in my comments, but I realized that's kind of the crux of what was just bothering me. Yeah. So do you ever get in? I bet you never get into internet arguments.
Very rarely. Very rarely. It has happened, but no, I usually keep my mouth shut. And then when I can't, you know, I usually don't engage. Like, I'll make a comment and then run away, kind of thing.
Yeah. And I did sort of shut down my, I didn't I went back and apologized because I didn't use it as a teaching opportunity and I didn't engage fully. It would have taken a lot of effort. There were a lot of comments, positive and negative. People agreed with me. People disagreed with me. I could have used it as a teaching opportunity and I didn't because I don't really have the time for it. So I don't know why I even started it in the first place. But then I thought we really should use the podcast this week as a teaching opportunity. Mm-hmm. So
great.
That's sort of where we're coming to this week's podcast from, which we are going to call, why did we say?
The problem with
the mommy wars.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Problem with the mommy wars. So her video is not even really relevant to this. I recorded a TikTok last night to just kind of explain why breastfeeding and chest feeding shouldn't be portrayed as part of the mommy wars narrative, because it's really, really complicated. There's a lot of contextual pieces to it. There's a lot of physiologic pieces to it. There's a lot of regional pieces to it, geographical pieces to it. It's extremely complex. Mm-hmm. And so TikTok has recently, I don't know if everybody gets them now, but we were recently awarded the 3-minute video. And so I thought, oh, good, I'll use this really long video that we have to explain this. And I realized 3 minutes is not actually enough time to do that. So right. We're going to dig even deeper today. So what we're going to start with is the reason why talking about breast versus bottle feeding or breast milk versus formula is not even really a useful choice to talk about. Mm-hmm. People talk about it as one of the many parenting choices that they have. Are you going to cloth diaper or do disposable diapers? Are you going to co-sleep or use a bassinet? Or are you going to breastfeed or bottle feed? And even in the hospital, are you going to do vitamin K or not do vitamin K? Are you going to do the hepatitis B vaccine or not? Are you going to breastfeed or bottle feed? It just is really presented as one of the many, many parenting choices that, that parents have to make. And it's actually something that most parents want to do. We have a lot of evidence. There's a lot of research from the CDC that shows that most parents want to breastfeed or chest feed their babies starting off. You know, so at the time that the baby is born, 84.1% of parents intend or actually initiate breastfeeding. So they actually start breastfeeding. For the sake of argument, we're going to say at the hospital. Now, we know more than anybody that not all babies are born at the hospital. But in the United States, I think approximately 97% of babies are born in the hospital.
Probably. That sounds about right.
I think it's like 2% home birth and 1% birth center or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, for the sake of the conversation, we're just going to talk about in the hospital, 84.1% of parents in the United States initiate breastfeeding. So that is really different based on where you live. Mm-hmm. So in Colorado, where we live, 92.2% of parents initiate breastfeeding. I was going to try to find the lowest. I think I know the lowest. I'm going to double check on this table. What do you think the state with the lowest initiation rate is?
Hmm.
I had to guess.
Oh my God.
It's not what I thought. I was just double checking the stats. It's not what I thought.
Let me think about who lives where.
I'm kind of surprised, actually.
I am going to say, I have no idea, but I'll say New Hampshire.
Oh, that's a surprising yep. I was thinking Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mississippi has, I believe, one of the highest neonatal and maternal mortality rate. So I think that's maybe what was in my head. Mississippi is actually 70%. Let's see, New Hampshire is 88.3. So they're great. Above the national average. New Hampshire, Vermont, those states usually do pretty well. But the East Coast is generally lower. for example, New York is 87. New York is above the national average.
I almost
picked
New York, but obviously I'm on the wrong track. I was thinking like, you know, people that are too busy to breastfeed.
That's what I yes. was thinking too with New York. So I, yes. but anyway, they're 87. They're above the national average, which is cool. Great. It looks to be that the lowest, and these stats are from the CDC 2020 breastfeeding report card, by the way. It looks like Louisiana is the lowest state with 66.2%. So there's a big range, 66 to 90 something percent. Oh, I wonder which state has the highest. I think we're up there, but I don't think we're the highest. Let's see. Oh, Idaho's 94.6. Go Idaho.
That's
Minnesota's 95.3.
Wow.
I was going to see what California was. 90.2, so lower than us. But in general, we have a trend where the West has higher rates than the East does. And the South has lower rates than the North, that kind of thing. Hmm. But so in any case, even with the lowest state at 66%, what that means is significantly more than half of parents start off wanting to breastfeed their babies.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on? So what we also know from the breastfeeding report card is that only 58.3% of babies are still breastfed at 6 months to any degree, and only 25.6% are exclusively breastfed at 6 months, which is the recommendation. So in this video, I talked about how, you know, different organizations have different recommendations for breastfeeding, chest feeding, not only initiation, but exclusivity and duration. So, you know, mm-hmm. how many babies should be starting off, you know, with, not everybody can. So we don't expect 100% ever.
Right.
How many babies should be breastfeeding at 6 months? And then exclusive breastfeeding at 6 months means that they don't take anything but the breast or breast milk at 6 months. And then most health organizations, the World Health Organization, most countries, health organizations, and I think even the American Family Practice Association usually recommend 2 years of continued breastfeeding after you introduce solids. But the American Academy of Pediatrics says at least a year of mm-hmm. breastfeeding with complementary food. So nobody says you should be weaning before a year.
Right.
Most people say 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so what we see is that most babies are not exclusively breastfed at 6 months, which is, you know, kind of a standard recommendation right. across the board. So what's happening? So where is that? What would you guess is happening? Why are we so far from the recommended?
I think it's probably a lot of stuff, but one is that I think we probably just have a lack of support in like coming from lots of directions. Mm-hmm. starting with being offered as a standard choice in your birth environment, and then continuing on to, you might still be surrounded by family that didn't mm-hmm. breastfeed, and so nobody knows how to help you, and there's still a lot of messaging that comes, you know, through the media, even though it's not supposed to, and then you get your little free formula, like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that's
quote,
like,
unquote, gift packs.
That's the thing, yeah. That gets a lot of people, because on day two in the middle of the night, and you're baby's hungry and your milk isn't in and you're weak and desperate, there's mm-hmm. your free formula
and you're right? exhausted and you just yes. had a baby and your
yeah.
bottom hurts and you're not comfortable and your nipples hurt and everything hurts
and you're worried that you're not adequately feeding your baby and
right.
you know, because you're a new mom and we're vulnerable and it's you know, so it's clear, you know, taking advantage of that mm-hmm. that state of mind mm-hmm. that they know yeah. that we're in.
Absolutely. I think, and I don't actually have this research, you know, right at my fingertips, but I think still the most impactful influence is partner support. I think that's still number one, is having a supportive partner. And I think that kind of just like in labor, like where people are like, well, are you sure you don't just want the epidural? I think that kind of happens with, you know, one bottle's not a big deal. You know, they just kind of, they just want to make it better. They see that you're struggling. They see, you're often crying is involved at this point. You know, they see a lot of struggle and they just want to help. So partner support is a really important determinant. Thank you. I couldn't and then, but in general, family support. So most, the next most influential person is your own mother. Your own mother is very, has a lot of influence on not only your decision to breastfeed, but also on your kind of success. And I really want to explain that when we talk about success or, you know, when we talk about breastfeeding failure, I think that the problem is words like success and failure are super value laden words.
Right.
And what we're really talking about is, are you meeting your own breastfeeding goals? Mm-hmm. And because almost 85% of new parents in this country want to breastfeed their babies, we know that most people's breastfeeding goals are to breastfeed, or, you know, breastfeeding goals are to be successful with that. So it's not really anybody else's goals. We're talking about helping people meet their own goals. Mm-hmm. But what you said at first about the facility or the healthcare system is actually really, really impactful. And one thing that the breastfeeding report card pulled out in 2020 was that 19.2% of babies that are in the hospital breastfeeding are supplemented with formula by day two. And that's exactly what you're saying, is that that second night is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be supplementing 19% of babies by day two is problematic for a lot of reasons. Right. So maybe let's talk about like what's normal on day two.
Well, it's normal for the baby to be starting to get hungry a little bit because it's part of the process. There's still colostrum. They're still getting plenty to eat. So there's not like an actual issue here. But, you know, as the days go by, their stomach starts to grow and they start to, you know, they want to bring the milk in. They want more food. And their ravenous nursing is part of what brings the milk in. So it's like supposed to happen. It's all supposed to happen.
They are supposed to really pick up their feeding. And in the first 24 hours, babies are often a little bit sleepy. Like birth was kind of hard for them too. Mm-hmm. And they're a little tired and sometimes don't really ask to nurse very often. What we tell our clients is that it's fine to take that one big stretch. And then you really want to encourage them to nurse frequently, because the more time that the baby spends at the breast or chest in the first 3 days actually determines the quantity of milk production. It actually activates prolactin receptors so that you can have an abundant milk supply for the rest of your time nursing. Mm-hmm. So that frequent time at the breast is biologically, you know, it's there in order to ensure an adequate milk supply.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things that happen to undermine that. The, you know, obviously offering the baby formula, they're acting starving, so you feel like you want to give them some food, mm-hmm. is one of the things. But even just offering a pacifier in the first 3 days can decrease the amount of time at the breast and negatively impact milk supply.
Right.
So both of those things are potentially going to undermine the establishment of breastfeeding. The other thing is a misunderstanding of colostrum. Colostrum is probably one of the most misunderstood substances or processes, colostrum feeding in the world. Almost every culture has misconceptions about colostrum. Namely that it's inadequate, but really colostrum is the perfect substance for your baby's first feeds. It is packed with immunity, and they have tiny little bellies. A baby at birth, their belly is only about, you know, only has the capacity of about 5 to 10 milliliters, which is 1 to 2 teaspoons. Mm-hmm. And so colostrum is just the perfect quantity for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's full of immunity, and it also kind of lines the baby's gut with, introduces the baby's gut to a whole host of really good probiotics. It helps colonize the baby appropriately. And it also has a laxative effect to help clear out that meconium, mm-hmm. and also the broken down red blood cells and prevent jaundice. So, you know, the more the baby poops in the first 3 days, the less likely they are to have jaundice that needs to be treated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because their liver isn't really able to do that. So we need another mechanism. And so really frequent nursing and taking in colostrum is a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just a conception worldwide that it's not enough. And so we call those pre-lacteal feeds. So before the milk is in, quote unquote, mm-hmm. In many cultures, there's different foods that the babies are offered. It could be anything from a gruel, a porridge, to, you know, herbal water things, yeah. Glucose, sugar water.
It's so funny. It is, I almost laughed when you said that, in fact, like, colostrum is the perfect food for a baby. And I'm like, of course it is. Like, this is... we're mammals, and this is what mm-hmm. every mammal does, mm-hmm. and what our caveman ancestors did, cavewoman, that's what they had to eat. They didn't have stuff to give their babies. They gave them colostrum.
They didn't have stuff to give their babies, but they probably relied on wet nursing. It is probably something that has gone on since the beginning of time, because you don't feel like you have any milk.
Because our human brains, like, as soon as we could reason out doubts about our babies and our ability to mother, then we did, and we used wet nurses. You're absolutely right. Well, I'm just telling you, whales don't use wet nurses. I bet
they don't. They don't. So there is just like this certain amount of trust and faith, and going with the flow,
mm-hmm.
and going with the flow means that you're probably going to have a fussy baby on night two.
Right.
There's a certain amount of acceptance and surrender that happens there too.
Yep.
So it's just biologically normal for babies to be a little fussy and act hungry on day two. This is normal. This is normal infant behavior. And interfering with that process can negatively influence not only the establishment of breastfeeding, because sometimes babies that get an artificial nipple, whether a pacifier or a bottle, actually start preferring that. We've all heard about nipple confusion. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of in the camp that doesn't think it's a giant risk most of the time, mm-hmm. But it certainly can make a difference for some babies.
Yeah.
But it also can negatively impact the establishment of the supply itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really normal for babies to be a little fussy on day two. It's really normal to want to give the baby something else to eat. And that is where, that's probably the first big hurdle that comes up, is that people are either getting formula in the hospital, or they were sent home with a formula, quote unquote, gift bag, mm-hmm. or they had it on their doorstep when,
right.
you know, because they ordered clothes from certain mainstream maternity clothes store or something like that. And mm-hmm. they got on the mailing list and they get the mm-hmm. gift. I nobody can see my air quotes, but they're called gift boxes.
Every time Gina says gift, there's air quotes. So. Yeah,
it's not a gift. It's not a gift to undermine breastfeeding. And that is what they do. And if they didn't work, trust me, they would not send out free formula to every new parent in the country.
Because they're not allowed to do traditional marketing the same way as, you know, other companies can. And so they are sneaky.
Well, what do you mean they're not allowed to?
Isn't that the thing? Like the, what is it called, Gina?
The WHO code?
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, the WHO code.
I mean, in theory, they're not allowed
they
to.
They do it anyway.
But the United States didn't sign, is not a signer.
Oh, we just don't. We just don't follow it in the United
States. We just pretend like it's not a thing.
Oh,
we'll try to link to the WHO code podcast. Yeah. No, they do. They do still market it. They're trying to make it seem less insidious, but it's still insidious, and it works. And that's the thing.
Yeah,
marketing works. And what it means for formula marketing to work is that people will switch to formula, either partially or fully.
Mm-hmm.
It will be their baby's formula, and so it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big problem. So circling back to the mommy wars, what we have here is this idea that people are choosing breast or bottle. So on one hand, they're not really choosing that. They're really choosing to breastfeed, mm-hmm. making a decision to breastfeed, and mm-hmm. then having a lack of support at various steps along the way. And by the way, if they don't get you on day two, there's all kinds of places where the system can fail to support a new parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once you have a clogged duct, or they might tell you not to nurse if you have the flu, or they might, you know, there's a whole host of ways that you could get bad information, or maybe don't nurse if you are taking a certain medication that is actually completely safe, like antibiotics or something like that. People just blanketly say, don't do all these things if you're breastfeeding. And it turns out most of those things aren't actually contraindicated.
Right.
So there's a number of ways in the, you know, especially in the first 6 months where parents are, it's almost like pummeling them with bad information and withholding support from them or withholding mm-hmm. assistance.
Right.
And it's really, it's just really sad. It's just, So when we talk about the choice, it's really, it's a false equivalency. It's sort of like saying, was somebody able to overcome all of these obstacles and barriers, or was somebody not able to overcome all of these obstacles and barriers?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's, and then what happens is, because it's so important to us on this really deep level, we have to rationalize and justify and explain why we're not breastfeeding. And really, first of all, we don't have to do that. You don't owe anybody an explanation, but we feel obligated to do that. And there becomes a sort of defensiveness that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, that's where the mommy wars comes up. Like, well, you're not breastfeeding. Well, I don't have to breastfeed. My baby's fine. My baby's healthy. You know, like, it just, there's this argument that happens that really means it's really more of an indication that somebody didn't get the support they needed. Not breastfeeding means somebody didn't get the support they needed.
Right.
And I would argue that the 16% that didn't initiate in the country possibly didn't have really good information about it. So there was maybe a breakdown in the prenatal education. Mm-hmm. We do know that not everybody can or should breastfeed their baby. I mean, that's obvious. That's an obvious statement. Just like from the midwifery perspective, not everybody can or should have a vaginal birth.
Right.
There's a time and a place for an intervention. But I really hope that we can start to reframe formula feeding as an intervention rather than a parenting choice.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it is a medical intervention, and it's sometimes really needed. And we're so lucky that we have food to feed our babies when we need that. So it's just, But I think a lot, like even with my own experience, I don't even know, you know, even though I have definitely had with a couple of my babies a supply issue that was due to hormones, you know, so it was just really, really difficult to overcome. And then with one of my babies, I couldn't overcome it. Mm-hmm. My first baby, I don't even know if I had any kind of a problem, because it was just a lack of support that, you know, I didn't have a mother that had breastfed. I didn't have any sisters that had had babies yet. Mm-hmm. I, you know, had friends that, you know, it was like the youngest one having babies, mm-hmm. or the first mm-hmm. one having Me babies. Too. And so it, you know, so I didn't really have friends. And then like the one that was closest that had a baby was like the one that's like supplementing with formula. So that's where her perspective of support comes from. And yeah, so it's just like, you're just hanging out there. Mm-hmm. The pediatrician doesn't care. I mean, that one didn't care. Some of them do.
Well, and I think that they, you know, that it's interesting. There's very little about lactation in medical school. Mm-hmm. That is mm-hmm. one of the things that Dr. Neifert, who's a pediatrician here in Denver, has tried to fix here in our area, is making sure that medical students have some lactation education. But I think that I can see how it feels safer to just make sure the baby's being fed.
Right.
And because occasionally we have to recommend supplementing mm-hmm. a baby too. It's not like we never have to recommend that sure. a baby's supplemented.
Yeah.
But I just think that there's a lot more, what do I want to say? A lot more moving parts to making sure that a person is getting the lactation support that they need, and a lot more follow-up and a lot more observation and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. following the client or the patient that you have to do when you're kind of trying to deal with a complicated lactation situation or a complicated feeding situation. Mm-hmm. So I can see it. I can see how it's just feels safer and easier to say, let's just get the baby some formula for now, and then we'll deal with this later. And then actually it turns out it's a slippery slope.
Right.
And the formula now can, you know, very quickly escalate into not breastfeeding at all.
Right, right. Exactly.
And I should mention, it's not just, you know, breastfeeding or chest feeding or formula. There's a bunch of stuff from sure. donor milk to all kinds of things in there. But just for the sake of the simplicity of the argument, that's how we're framing it yeah. today.
It's not like donor milk is super easy to get for some people. So
no, it's either quite expensive and needs a prescription, or it's informal milk sharing, which has its own host of, mm-hmm. you know, people have concerns about that, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. I do think that we would go on record and say that we really only support commercial tested formula. I mean, as much as it is a problem, and goodness knows we have our issues with it, we just don't recommend any types of homemade formula, because they are not there's no oversight whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's already right. challenges with oversight of commercial mm-hmm. formula.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to, you know, disclaimer. Out there. Yeah. It's just in our circles, there's a lot of people that want to do homemade formulas, and it's right.
It did that. Problematic. It did that. And it didn't work, by the way. Just so you know, just so everyone knows, my baby did not grow on homemade formula. So
was that your last? Did you try it with your last baby? Because uh-huh. I remember.
I know it was you were with me on that journey, because I had fed, like, my giant son, I fed him, and he exclusively breastfed, and he was fine. And then my third baby still did well until I ran into a problem that killed my milk supply, you know, but we did well for 7 months.
Mm-hmm, which is great.
And then the last one, it would not grow. And then, like, I just didn't want to do formula. And so then, you know, I did one of the recipes, and it did, you know, it's not the same. The molecules are not the same. It doesn't work.
It's not appropriate for.
Yeah.
It's not appropriate for mm-hmm. human babies. But I didn't know you that well, but I remember being like,
yeah,
just do formula.
we'll just hope he's okay, everybody.
He seems
okay.
But it is like because the narrative has been painted that breast milk is good and formula is bad.
Right.
Because of that narrative, mm-hmm. because of the false mommy war situation.
Right. Exactly.
because of that, people are also afraid of it, and they don't need to be afraid of right. it.
And then there's the failure thing that you mentioned, like you can't give up. Like if you're not going to breastfeed, then you have to like kill yourself making like this crazy concoction so that you're still.
I can't even imagine on a personal level the, I don't want to say just the angst of being a home birth midwife who's struggling to breastfeed. Yes, I'm sure exactly. that that's
so you must remain crunchy enough is what I am saying here.
And that sounds like a lot of pressure.
And yes.
I'm acknowledging that you went through that. I'm really sorry for you that you went through that. Oh, so it's interesting, like the number of people that are going to have a true problem is in line with the number of people who have metabolic disorders of one type or the other. So mm-hmm. thyroid conditions, diabetes, you know, those kind of things are going to be, mm-hmm. it's going to be similarly represented in the population who will have problems with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's other types of issues besides hormone related, but it's, what am I trying to say? Like analogous to other, right. other metabolic disorders.
Right. Right, exactly.
So that means like 95% of people are going to be able to provide breast milk mm-hmm. if given good support. That if given good support is a giant if. That's a right. huge if.
Right.
And what we're saying, the point of all of this is that people are not being given good support. So what would it look like if everybody who said, I want to breastfeed my baby was given the tools, the support, the follow through that they needed to meet those goals, it would be completely different. But instead, uh-huh. we take that lack of support and resources and we turn that on ourselves and we decide this means that we failed somehow. And then there's a defensiveness. Mm-hmm. And that defensiveness impacts not only your friends, like, you know, who you're influencing in your social circles, but also your children mm-hmm. because we don't get over it. Because how many 50, 60, 70-year-old ladies have you heard mm-hmm. tell their breastfeeding stories to you?
Oh, yeah. Lots.
Because it is intricately entwined mm-hmm. with who we are as mothers. Mm-hmm. And so when the system fails us, we hold on to that. And we blame ourselves and we falsely shame other people for it. And actually, I don't see that much shaming happening. I think it's more defensiveness on both ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there are people out there who are just like, nope, it's not for me, not going to do it. And I think that's totally legit. It's your choice to just say, this is not something I'm comfortable with. But most of the time when people have that story, they're coming with something happened to them.
Right. So it's so just like, flips the story around so that mm-hmm. they, you know, are not internalizing failure.
Mm-hmm. And I don't push that hard. I mean, I know midwives who push harder. Mm-hmm. I actually think I don't want people to feel coerced into anything.
Right. And there's a line, you know, where, I mean, and it just, you know, it's up to the whatever's going on to determine what the line is, but it's, you know, sometimes the mental distress of trying to mm-hmm. power through a hard situation is just mm-hmm. too much, you know, and that's.
And it can okay. be horrible. It can be horrible mm-hmm. feeling like you've harmed your baby or
yeah.
you're not doing enough or.
Yes, it you can. Know.
So yeah. if you had a situation where you had a baby that wasn't growing adequately, it can feel really, I mean, you know, it can feel really yeah. terrible.
Terrible that my baby wasn't growing. Like, it's a terrible feeling. So you just.
So, you know, if people want to explore it, I'm happy to explore that with them. But if they don't, that's completely yeah. okay. But I want people to know that it's almost like a trauma that happened. Yeah. It is like a trauma that happened. Mm-hmm. And they're having a response to that. And there's a lot of okay ways to do mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. Probably somebody failed you along the way. Mm-hmm. And that's what the point of this is, mm-hmm. is that if somebody is internalizing and being, and feeling defensive about something, it probably is actually completely not your fault and completely somebody else, somewhere along the line, the system or the people that were supposed to be supporting you did not do their jobs. And so we need to change that.
So
that's it. It's really, I don't know. It's just, you know, the bottom line is, if most people want to do this, we need to make sure that people are getting the support that they need. If people don't want to do it, cool. Totally cool. But don't turn it into this thing.
Have you ever had someone just, somebody without medical issues, have you ever had them choose not to breastfeed in your practice?
I've had...
Not having difficulties and then discontinuing, but like from the onset.
No. So I've never had a first time parent say, I'm not going to breastfeed. I've had people that have had challenges with either the past child or more than one child. Sometimes it's just something like breast surgery, like augmentation, which you don't expect to impact supply, but it can make it really hard to, it can cause some complications. So one was a situation like that. Another one was somebody who had, with two babies, had literally tried everything, clearly had an underlying tissue, you know, insufficient glandular tissue disorder, and just was like, I just can't go through that again. And I, like, by all means, I would opt out of the stress of doing it again, for sure. Just, it's so hard, you know. So I've had people, so no, I haven't had anybody who didn't have a hard situation precipitating it. But I have had a couple people who, because of hard situations, didn't. How about you?
Just one. That's why I was, when you were doing the statistics, I mean, obviously a home birth practice is going to be different.
That's a skewed, that's a selection bias.
Population. But I just, like, I ran my percentages, and it was 0.1% of my clients have not initiated breastfeeding, you know, for a non-medical reason.
For non-medical. If you added ours together, that would be even lower then.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you're doing your calculation. Well, it's easy when it's one person.
Right.
Easy calculations. Yeah. It's not fair. It's not fair to compare the home birth population to the general population. It's a completely different set of characteristics. But occasionally somebody who has had past difficult experiences, really only two. And people that I have thought to myself, boy, I wouldn't try as hard as, you know what I mean? Like, people have gone way beyond where I would have gone. And I take my hat off, and I am there to support them as much as I possibly can, because I want them to do. And let me just, maybe as long as we're talking about it, for people that have had prior difficult experiences, insufficient supply, insufficient glandular tissue, babies with anomalies, you know, all kinds of things like that, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. But there are many, many of the health implications are impacted by exclusivity. So that's why when we talk about the recommendation is to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months, it's because it's not going to have the same impact if you are mixing feeds, but you can, if you need to, and still, which is what you did, and still get a lot of the, you know, still realize a lot of the, I don't like to use the word benefits. I'm trying really hard to find another word. A lot of the, things that breastfeeding can convey, like orthodontic development and bonding, and there is some immunity even in partial milk supply, but it's not the full impact that exclusive breastfeeding conveys.
So, you know, oddly, and I've mentioned this before, but oddly, after like all of the struggle of, you know, the initial period of, you know, figuring out that we're having a milk supply problem, and like, and then doing all the things like the SNS and all of horrible, which works for some people. I don't want to diss it, but it was really stressful. After arriving at the just acceptance of he's going to have supplemental feeds, we actually had a fabulous breastfeeding relationship. And it was the longest one I've had with any of my babies. And it was like not stressful at all. So it was like, he probably nursed more than any of them did, you know, in terms of like the bonding and the development of the jaw and all that stuff. So it's,
yeah,
do your best.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so it's not about what is any one person doing. It's about, are we making sure that everybody has the support that they need to make it work for them in the way that they want to make it work for them. That's not always the way that we would do it, but
yeah,
I am 100% certain I would not have any patients with the SNS. Of that, I am quite sure.
No,
that would not be. I do not have the bandwidth for that. Oh, there we go. I've said it for my day. I'm only allowed to say bandwidth once a day, according to my husband. It's hard. It's frustrating. You need a high frustration tolerance for some of these things because it's a lot of work. And I know that I would certainly not go to the lengths that some of my clients go to. I really have mad respect for them. So that's sort of what this is about. I think we're just encouraging people to think about it as a societal problem and not an individual problem.
Yes.
And I think that's freeing. For me, it's freeing to think about the fact that it's not a personal win or loss. It's bigger than that. It's very, very complex, and we should respect that.
Definitely.
So, all right. Well, have a good week, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Don't forget to follow us on social, Instagram, TikTok. Oh my goodness, that's where this all stemmed from. Facebook, and at our website, www.metromidwifery.com. All right. Have a good week, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.